Well, on behalf of JBD, I'd like to welcome everybody to today's event, Child Custody and Family Law, a comparison of the approach in Halakha and Australian legal system. My name is David Werding. On behalf of JBD, I'd like to thank Jeremy and Rebecca, no relation, from Clagger Partners for hosting and sponsoring and putting on a really outstanding spread for lunch.
The best law firm in the city.
The best law firm in the city, in the category of law firms that you sit. So the format will be as follows. Rabbi Johnson will go first up. He'll speak for about 15, 20 minutes. After that, Rebecca will speak. And after that, we should have a bit of time for some questions and discussions. So first, Rabbi Johnson. Rabbi Johnson is Dean of the Kol HaMenachem College of Advanced Rabbinic Studies and Director of Adult Education at Yeshiva Centre in Melbourne. He's been a Torah teacher and lecturer for over 12 years. He's received smicha from Machon Chaim in Melbourne many years ago and studied under notable halakhic authorities in the US. He was also a full-time teacher for BINA, a Sydney-based adult education organisation in Sydney, and spent 5 years in Crown Heights directing the Manhattan Kollel and lecturing in Brooklyn. He's a highly sought-after speaker and lecturer. Over to Rabbi Johnson. Thank you.
Thank you, David, for the introduction, and thank you to Haigos for hosting this opportunity to share some words of Torah and at this opportunity, and I hope that it will be insightful to everyone here. So just a little bit of background. Traditionally, Jewish law, or what we refer to as halacha, is a system of law which covers every aspect of living. So not just the religious codes, such as the observance of Sabbath, kashrut, the dietary laws, etc., but also govern the civil law, so matters of contract, matters of torts, damages, disputes, employment, criminal code, etc. All of that was governed by a halachic judicial system. And then, of course, we also have family law. Family law, which refers to laws of marriage, kiddushin, divorce, gittin or gerushin, and laws of child support and child custody. All of this was within the jurisdiction of the system of rabbinic courts. And the rabbinic law itself, as applied, was deduced from rabbinic rulings over a period of many centuries, from the period of the Talmud, and it has its source, it's based in the written Torah, which is the five books of Moses. That is the source of rabbinic authority, and that is the source of the principles, which were then expounded and applied by the rabbis of a Beit Din. Now, of course, that was the system in biblical times when there was a commonwealth. The Jewish people had their own autonomy, and they were able to apply their jurisdiction across all areas of laws, all areas of Jewish living. Even under Roman rule, after the land of Israel was taken over by the Roman Empire, Jewish governance was still somewhat autonomous, and therefore the rabbinic courts, the Sanhedrin, and the various Beit Dins in each city were able to function and administer Jewish law in their communities. Even in, let's say, more recent times, when we talk about medieval Europe, we find that there were some semi-autonomous Jewish communities which were empowered by the monarchs of the time to be able to apply Jewish law and to deal with matters in-house within the Jewish community to manage the internal affairs. However, by and large today, where we have Jews living in the modern world, in countries such as Australia, the US and the like, pretty much the scope of the power, the authority of a Beit Din has been very much limited and reduced to select areas. And in a lot of the areas, whilst with the advent of arbitration, people can elect to go to rabbinic arbitration for various areas, but we are certainly subject to what is referred to as dina de malchus, dina, that the law of the land is law, and therefore the application of laws of child custody, which we're going to be discussing today, is pretty much something which has not been administered by Jewish courts, even though traditionally it was, but is not done in our society today, with the exception of one place in the world, and that is Israel. The modern state of Israel, I have to tell you, the first time I went to a lawyer's office in Israel was to do with visa papers, etc., and I walked into the legal office, and as I expected to see, I saw, you know, all of the various cases and all the books on the shelf, and then I noticed on the top shelf a set of Talmud, and alongside it a set of Shulchan Aruch, the code of Jewish law. And that was not because the lawyer that I was engaging was an observant Jew, but because in the Israeli civil system there is recognition given to Talmudic process, to Talmudic law, so therefore he had that there as a reference as well. However, going outside of the civil court system in Israel, we also have the chief rabbinate. The chief rabbinate, which is under the auspices of the chief rabbinate of Israel, have a series of courts, the high court sitting in Jerusalem itself. And in matters of family law, they have the ability to have jurisdiction to give rulings. Now, what actually comes out is interesting is whereas the laws of marriage and divorce are exclusively in the hands of the Beit Din, of the courts, the Israeli Jewish court system, matters of child custody and child support, etc., actually can sit with either the jurisdiction of the rabbinic courts or with the civil courts. And it really becomes a bit of a game where the litigants go to first when they're in argument, because there are, as we'll see in the course of today's discussion, differences of how the Beit Din would apply their laws and their directives in matters of child custody as opposed to the courts. The general accepted practice is amongst observant Jews that they would take, or the expectation is that they would take their matter before the Beit Din, which is always the preference. And but we do have cases that end up in the civil courts, and we have appeals going from the Beit Din to the civil court and vice versa as well. So if we look at the halachic perspective, if we look at the Torah's perspective, we have to go through a series of what is the source of the Torah law. So just quickly to run through. So obviously we have the Bible, that was God-given code, to the five books of Moses was given, and in that we have a nucleus of many of the laws. So for example, the father's obligation to support, support his wife and to support his family financially, that is a biblical law, that is something explicit in the Torah and the five books. We then have the source of rabbinic law, which is found in the Mishnah and the Talmud, which is a codification of oral law and the rulings of the rabbis and various discussions which they have. One looks in the Talmud and we find debate, interpretation, and analysis. And then we have the commentaries on the Talmud, starting off with an era known as the Rishonim, the early scholars. The early scholars, some of the names you might may have heard is Rashi, Rambam, the Rosh, etc., some of the names that I will speak about. And the early scholars had different styles. So some of them wrote in the form of commentary on the Talmud, and in there you find their legal rulings. Some of them actually wrote codes of law. So for example, Maimonides, the Rambam, wrote the Mishneh Torah, which is a compendium of the full gamut of Torah law, both biblical and rabbinic, across all areas. And then we have responsa, that they would be questions would be submitted to the great rabbis at the time. They would write up their rulings, and those rulings became published or became widespread, and that also forms a base for the law. And then we have the Beit Din rulings, as in each time we had the individual localized Beit Din, and we see the rulings that they issued in specific cases as well. Moving along, we then have the codification of the Shulchan Aruch. The Shulchan Aruch, written by Rabbi Yosef Karo, brought together all of this wealth of literature from the Mishnah, Talmud, and through the commentaries of the Rishonim to try and give a definitive ruling. Because as we're going to see, that we have machlokes, it's pretty much arguments between Jewish sages, is as age old as the Torah itself. You know, you ask two rabbis, you get three answers, that type of stuff. That was happening in this era. Rabbi Yosef Karo, by compiling the Shulchan Aruch, sought to systemize and have one system of law which would be universal across the Jewish world. And of course, he was going against thousands of years of Jewish nature, and he was unsuccessful. And then on that, we have, therefore, further commentaries on the Shulchan Aruch. Some of them will actually take issue and argue with the rulings of the Shulchan Aruch. And then we have more contemporary, who are referred to as the Achronim, the contemporary authorities, with their responsa. And today we have also the published rulings, or many of the published rulings, of the Jewish courts in Eretz Yisrael, in the land of Israel, under the chief rabbinate. And we have their rulings, which are written up in case form as well. So that's a little bit of a background. So we're going to jump straight into the Talmudic rulings on child custody, and these are derived from the Talmud. I brought here the wording of the Maimonides, the Rambam, just because I feel that this actually encapsulates the ruling in the clearest way. And this is actually almost verbatim the rulings of the Shulchan Aruch as well. So the Rambam, based on the Talmudic principles, actually says that there will be differences. When we apply the child custody, there will be differences depending on the gender of the child and depending on the age of the child. And these are the basic rules that set forth. So just quickly to run through them. So first of all, from 0 to 2, we have a nursing child. Classically, in Talmudic times, the age of weaning was 24 months. So from 0 to 2, in the absence of formula, the absence of other feeding sources, either a mother would nurse her own child or would be outsourced to a wet nurse. Someone would be employed to nurse the child. So the Rambam rules as follows. If a woman is divorced, so she cannot be compelled to nurse the child unless she wishes to do so. And if she's nursing the child, so then the father has to provide, he has to provide her a way, so to speak, her maintenance to be able to look after the child. If she does not wish to nurse the child, so then she gives the son to the father and says, you deal with it, he's your responsibility, and he will have to find another lady to nurse the child. Then the Rambam qualifies and says, when is this? This is only if the mother had not already started nursing, because the presumption is once a child has started to nurse and is used to the mother, he will not be, or she will not be able to transfer across to an alternative source. And therefore, if the mother is not going to continue nursing, this is considered a sakana, the child's life is in danger without an adequate source of food. And therefore, the mother in that case is obligated to continue. Okay, so the premise over here, 2 points to highlight, is that we see that the primary concern at this stage is the child's physical welfare and well-being, that they're nursing, their survival. The mother has a right to nurse, and the preference is that the mother nurses the child rather than someone else, and if she does so, she has full custody of the child at that age. And the responsibility of support remains with the father, and he is obligated to provide not only for the child, but also an extra maintenance to his ex-spouse in order to be able to buy the food, etc., necessary for her to be able to have the ability to nurse the child as well. Okay, that's from 0 to 2. Then we move from 2 to 6, the tender age child. So the Rambam and the Shulchan Aruch rule that once they've reached the age of 24 months and they have been weaned, so if they're still nursing, then they remain with the mother. If they've been weaned and have reached the age of 24 months, so then as follows. If the mother desires, so then all of the children, including the sons, belong or remain with her, in her custody, and they cannot be taken away from her until the son is 6 years old. And at that point, what we do is that while the mother has full custody, we compel the father to pay what is referred to as mezonos, that is support, to be able to look after his children. That is his obligation. And we'll talk about this rationale a little bit. But basically, the Talmud, in a couple of places, makes a statement that this age bracket, up until the age of 6, are tender years of a child, and therefore a child needs the nurturing of his mother. So for example, the Talmud in Eruvin will say that if a father makes an Eruv in this direction and a mother makes it in that direction, the children under 6 go along with the mother because that is the natural bond, a mother and a child at that age, and therefore the custody based on the Talmud would sit there with the mother for all children under the age of 6. Then this is where we now introduce the father. Once children are over 6 years old, so the Shulchan Aruch rules that after 6 years, the father is able to now say that if my son is with me, then I will take care of him. But however, if he remains with his mother, I will no longer pay any support. And he is able to do so because from the age of 6, I see some nods of heads. Don't jump. These are rules, and we're going to see how they are interpreted and how they are applied. Okay? So, because the presumption at this point is that it is at the best interest of a boy, of a son, to be raised by the father, and if the mother wishes to go against that, then the father has the right to say that I will not pay any support. However, the final line, the Rambam and the Shulchan Aruch rules that a daughter remains with her mother la'olam forever, even after the age of 6. So this is where you really have then the splitting when I mentioned age and gender, is that from the age of 6 and up, the default are the boys are raised by the father and girls are raised by the mother, and we will see the rationale for that shortly. Now, in the next halacha, all of this obviously assumes that the mother wants to have custody of her children. If at any point she decides she does not wish to have custody of her children, so the burden sits on the father. They are his children. He has the obligation of maintenance support for his children, and therefore they fall to him. And in the absence of a father, technically a mother could then give over her children to responsibility of a bet din or the community to look after, because a woman without a source of income did not have that responsibility of supporting the children. It became a responsibility of the community. So before we go on and look at the rationale, let's just quickly have a look if there are any qualifications on this ruling. So number one, if you remember, the Rambam says that from the age of 2 to 6, if the mother desires, then even the sons remain with her, because this is the tender age. The Ravid, who argues frequently on the Rambam, challenges this and says that how does this fit with the father's obligation of teaching his son Torah? Father has an obligation from the age of 4 or 5 to begin teaching his son Torah. If the son is under 6 and is with the mother, then the father doesn't have the ability to do so. So he challenges the Rambam. Now, Rabbeinu Nissim, also one of the North African Rishonim, he resolves this by explaining as follows. And it's quite a powerful idea. He says that when we talk about a boy under the age of 6, when you have an attachment, when you have a bonding with the mother, to take the child and separate him in those tender years from that environment is actually detrimental to the well-being of the child on many levels, emotionally, psychologically, and possibly physically as well. And therefore, that supersedes the father's obligation of teaching Torah to their child. And therefore, the Ran doesn't have a problem with that. However, the Shulchan Aruch, the commentaries on the Shulchan Aruch, do address the concern of the Ravid, and they say as follows. Yes, the father does have an obligation of teaching Torah to his son. However, he can fulfill that through visitations, through spending time with the son, even though the custody sits with the mother. And then this brings up, of course, discussions which we find in the responsa. Well, what happens if they're not living in the same city, for example, or the mother wishes to move away with the child, and that would then take away the right, the obligation of the father to teach his child Torah. So then that would be a situation where some authorities would say that even though the child is under 6, but the son would then move to the father at a younger age, that he would be able to teach him as well. So that's one issue. Another issue which is brought up, the Torah says that the custody of daughters with the mother is only in a case of death of the husband. If there's death of the husband, and it means either the daughter will remain with her mother or with the departed's family, so then the preference is that the daughter remains with the mother forever. However, the Shulchan Aruch categorically disagrees with this and says in all cases, whether it's by death or divorce, daughters remain with the mother for life. And finally, number 3 is that boys over 6, and this is very interesting. We said as follows, that once a boy reaches the age of 6, it sounds like the Beit Din comes with their guards and they take the sons away from the mother and they take them to the father. Is this so? Now, if you actually go back and look at the wording of the Rambam as follows, it seems, and this is one of the views, is that it is purely an issue of support. That the father doesn't have a right to then take custody of the children. But if boys over 6 remain with the mother, the father is no longer obligated to pay their maintenance. But that does not mean that he's able to go and take them. That's one view put forward, and that is put forward by the Mari Ibn Khabib. There is another view which says that no, and this is one of the accepted views. The Magen Mishnah says that no, this means that at that point the Beit Din can order the transfer of the son once he reaches 6 from the mother to the father's custody. And then you have a third view which is brought by the Mabit, which is the first time we actually introduce the child into the equation over here, is that we follow the son's preference. Meaning, if the son has no preference, then the default is that custody will transfer to the father at the age of 6. If the son does have a preference to remain with the mother, then the son is listened to as is adhered to. Now, the question is, everything I've spoken to now, are these rules set in stone? Are these absolute rules? Or are they merely recommendations or presumptions by the sages? Now, the universal or almost universal approach of the commentaries on the Talmud and the halachic codes is that they are only presumptive statements, and that the fundamental underpinning issue which underlies everything over here is what is the best interest of the child, and assuming where both parents are equally capable of looking after the child, both parents have the ability and the well-being to be able to do so, so that's when the Talmudic laws apply. However, if there is a case where we have a preference based on the best interest of the child, then those laws can be superseded because they're treated merely as recommendations. Now, if we go back to understand why we have the recommendations, so this is a comment from the Rama in the Shulchan Aruch. The Shulchan Aruch says that this is all, everything we've spoken to is dafka specifically where the Beis Din sees that it is preferable for the daughter to remain with the mother. However, if they see it is better for the daughter to move and have custody with the father, so then the mother is not able to prevent this. And the same would be vice versa. If the Beis Din determines that it is preferable for boys to be with the mother, they would be able to do so as well. So let's look at the rationale of best interest of the child. So 0 to 2 years old, when a child is nursing, the primary factor is the physical well-being of the child. We don't need to discuss that because that is quite obvious. From the age of 2 to 6, we see a strong emphasis on the emotional attachment and the psychological condition of the child, because these are tender years and therefore the default is that the child is, the custody is with the mother. However, from the age of 6, this is the focus is, as defined by the Rashba, Rav Shlomo ben Aderes, is that our goal is educating and raising the children to be productive Jewish members of society, family, and community. And for that, they need to see role modeling. That is, the parents, a boy has to grow up to be a fulfilled, committed Jewish male, and the daughter needs to grow up to be an observant, fulfilled, contributive Jewish female, and they therefore need to see the role model. So to have a daughter raised by her father would preclude that, she would not have the role modeling, and to have a son raised by the mother, so the son would be missing that role modeling as well. And that is as the way the Rashba of Shlomo ben Aderes defines the issue over here. Okay. The determination of what is considered the best interest of the child. So the Rashba tells us that sits with a Beis Din, and that is based on a Talmudic dictum that the Beis Din are avihen shel yosoimin. That the Beis Din, the rabbinic courts, are considered like the fathers, the parents, the guardians of orphans, and therefore they are empowered to make, they're divinely empowered to make decisions on custodial rights and where children will be looked after and they'll be raised. And we'll see how that is plays out as well a little bit later. Okay, we have what weight do we give to the Talmudic presumption? So on one hand, we're looking at the best interest of the child. On the other hand, we've set forth presumptions there. So what weight is given to each one of those? The Beis Shmuel says that it's actually, you know, there is significant weight given to the laws the way they are found in the Talmud. Something interesting, this is from one of the rulings in the Beis Din in Israel, parental rights versus child's interest. The Dayan, I believe it was Dayan Goldschmidt, said that there are no rights to either mother or father, only responsibilities upon them to raise and educate the children. When they come before the Beis Din for determination, there is only one consideration before our eyes. Where is it best for the child to be placed? Rights of parents are treated as though they do not exist. Meaning that one can look at matters of custody as a dispute between parents as to what their rights are, or on the flip side you have what is the best interest of the child. Sometimes you have an overlap of them, but in a halachic sense, the overall driver, and according to some authorities, the only driver is the interest of the child, and therefore you can theoretically have a situation where a Beis Din will decide to remove the child from custody of either parent and place them either into a foster care or into an institution and to be raised and looked over after over there. To look at a couple of cases, so we have a classic tshuva of the Rosh, and in this response of the Rosh talks about the like we spoke about the role model, the role modeling of behavior, that the daughters have to remain with the mother and the boys will remain with the father. However, bearing in mind the best interest of the child, he says that if the welfare of the child is at stake, so to speak, or they'll be looked after and cared for better by being with the mother or the mother's family, then that would be the consideration over there. We have an interesting tshuva, two interesting tshuvas of the Radvaz, David ben Zimri. One of the tshuvas, going back to the rationale of the Rashba, who says that a child, a daughter, remains with the mother because that is reflective of her, that is where she learns how to be a Jewish mother. So he talks about a case where the daughter was with the mother fell pregnant out of wedlock, and therefore the Beis Din said that even if the father didn't actually come forward to claim custody of his daughter, they would have taken her into foster care because they saw that she was not a fit role model for a daughter to emulate the standards of modesty within a Jewish community. In a similar case, we find the Radbaz also addresses issues of welfare as well. Okay, can the Beis Din remove custody of a parent to another relative? In short, yes they can, if that is seen to be best. The Radbaz says that a maternal grandmother comes in place of a mother, so if the mother passes away, then custody will be awarded to a maternal grandmother, because again, we need to have that feminine role model, and that would take precedence over a father. That is, however, disputed. The Rosh says that the presumption is that a daughter would prefer to obviously be in the custody of her father than to be with the mother's family, and that would take precedence because we presume that that would be the daughter's interest. Other determining factors, so primarily we look at the physical welfare and care of the child and their emotional and psychological well-being. Then we look at spiritual development. So for example, if they're loggerheads, the preference is given to the physical welfare of a child above the spiritual well-being of the child. When we talk about the child's preference and opinion, so we've already seen some authorities do give weight to that. Certainly when a child reaches bar bas mitzvah 13 or 12, they're considered to have enough intelligence to be able to make a determination of themselves where they wish to be, provided the Beit Din can see that this is not a coerced opinion, but this is the genuine interest of the child. Remaining with siblings is a consideration which is used by the Beit Din as well. Looking at a couple of case studies, so it's brought out the idea that rabbinic, one has to consult as well. That means consult with community leaders, consult with family members, consult with, in today's world, professionals as well. They can issue conditional rulings. So for example, if there is the welfare is determined to be better with the mother, but the mother is not necessarily as committed to a religious lifestyle, the court can order that the mother must provide an adequate Jewish education. Bonding and attachment of a child, so even over the age of 6, if they can see that the child is very attached, then that they may decide to remain with the mother. Something interesting, one of the court rulings was that whilst there was a custody awarded to one parent, but the condition that was actually placed there, the Torah has an obligation of honoring for parents, and that's irrespective of the nature of the family, whether it's, you know, whole or broken at that point, and therefore they ordered that the mother must educate the child in this spirit as well. Okay, visitation rights go based on the same idea that it's about the best interest of the child, and therefore the court may decide that there should be no visitation whatsoever, or they may decide, they'll decide the frequency, the nature, and the duration of that as well, and they will consider the child's desire in making those decisions, but there is definitely an idea of benefit of having a meaningful relationship with both parents, and that is independent of support. So meaning even if the father were to not support the child at all, that would not affect visitation, because visitation is not the father's right, but the interest of the child. Okay, I've been called for time, and we can maybe come back for part two at another time. So thank you very much.
Thanks very much, Rabbi Johnson. That was a lot in a relatively short amount of time. So let's move it on, and I hope everyone will be able to stay and give Rebecca a reasonable chance to present the other side of things. Rebecca is a special counsel at Klager Partners, over 17 years experience exclusively in family law, experience with all aspects of family matters, especially with complex parenting disputes, including interstate and international relocation. She's conducted many family law cases in the family court and federal magistrates court. So without further ado, Rebecca, thank you.
I'll try to make my part of the presentation today half as interesting. Sorry, I'll just try and skip through. There we go, I'm here. Okay, so the framework for determining parenting disputes is set out in Part 7 of the Family Law Act. It's over 80 sections which deal with parenting issues, dealing with parenting arrangements, child maintenance matters, enforcement of orders, and all sorts of things. So, just to give you the broad summary, the jurisdiction is held by the Family Court and the Federal Circuit Court. In 2006, there were quite substantial amendments to the Family Law Act, and you can see in 1996, the reference to custody, access, and guardianship, all of those terms were replaced with residence, contact, and specific issues. The rationale at that time was that children aren't chattels, they're people, so that was then carried further even more so in 2006 when the Act was changed again. And now when we advise our clients, we talk about orders that deal with where the children live and how they spend time with their parents. So at the first conference with our clients, we're generally going through all of the matters that I've got up here on this slide. We're talking about the children, their ages, any health or special needs, educational issues, working arrangements of both of the parents, trying to get an understanding of the history of the marriage and the parenting arrangements that were in place during the marriage, what the arrangements have been post-separation, proposals for the care of the children, and we also address arrangements for financial support, i.e. child support. It's really often the last two points there that cause the most dispute. I've sort of tried to summarise the approach that the court adopts in dealing with parenting disputes by putting it in a number of bullet points there. But essentially, the court starts off by identifying the parties' respective proposals and the issues in dispute between them, and then primarily is looking at what's in the best interests of the children by reference to certain matters that are set out quite clearly under Part 7 of the Act. The court then looks at whether there should be a presumption of shared parental responsibility, and if that presumption does apply, whether there should be equal time, i.e. children should live with their parents equally. If equal time is considered not to be in the best interests of the children or the child, the court then looks at significant or substantial time. So the objects and principles of Part 7. So the objects are listed here. They're essentially to ensure that the children have the benefit of both parents having meaningful involvement in their lives, protecting children from harm, exposure to abuse, neglect and violence, ensuring children receive adequate and proper parenting to help achieve their full potential, and ensuring parents fulfil their duties and responsibilities to the care of their children. The principles: children have a right to know and be cared for and spend time with and communicate with both parents. Parents should jointly share these responsibilities for the care, welfare and development of their children. Parents should agree, which is obviously the ideal, and children have a right to enjoy their culture. So the best interests of the child, that's the paramount consideration that the court takes into account. The court determines what's in the child's best interest by considering the objects and principles that I've just discussed and looking at a list of primary and additional considerations that are carefully set out in the Act. The primary considerations are that children, the benefit to a child of having a meaningful relationship with both parents, and the need to protect a child from harm, exposure to abuse and violence. And in applying those considerations, the latter overrides the former in the sense that if there are concerns about violence or abuse, that will override. The additional considerations, I've summarised some of them here. The main ones are the children's wishes and the weight that should be given to those wishes. Often our clients will say, well, at what age can my child express their views and when will that be the answer? There's no specific age set out in the Act. Children's wishes are taken into account, but obviously the weight that's attached to those wishes will depend on the age. The court looks at the nature of the child's relationship with each parent, the extent to which each parent has participated in making important decisions in respect of the child, the extent to which a parent has fulfilled financial obligations, the likely effect on a child of any significant change in their circumstances or separation from a parent, capacity of the parents to provide for the child's needs, family violence, and the court is always looking for the best option in terms of avoiding further proceedings in relation to parenting arrangements. Children's wishes. So children do not give evidence in family court proceedings, and their views are expressed via a family report. So in most cases, a psychologist will be appointed to meet with the parties and the children in different configurations, meet with the child, talk to them about their views, and they will be written out in a report which is filed in the proceedings. In really difficult cases, the court can also order the appointment of an independent children's lawyer, and that lawyer can actually speak directly with the children. In terms of parental responsibility, previously known as guardianship, this concerns major long-term decisions, schooling, religion, medical treatment, etc., changes of name. The primary position is that parents share this responsibility, but orders can be made limiting parental responsibility in circumstances where it's warranted, but orders for sole parental responsibility are generally very rare. They can be limited to a particular issue. So recently had a client who was involved in a very significant dispute with her former husband in relation to educational issues concerning their then four-year-old, almost five-year-old. The parties couldn't agree upon which private school she should attend. They both had proposals that were equally as compelling, but the dispute was so entrenched that this little girl actually missed the first 2 weeks of her prep year. It took that long to get the matter in the family court. Ultimately, the judge decided that these people can't make joint decisions. They're just not going to be able to do so. And the decision was made that the mother would have sole parental responsibility in relation to educational issues. So the court can dissect up parental responsibility if it's required and warranted. just in terms of the presumption, if there is shared parental responsibility, and that is the majority of cases, that presumption can be rebutted. If it's not rebutted, then the court needs to consider equal time. So often we'll have clients that come in, particularly fathers, who will say, well, I would like to have equal time with my children. We then need to actually work through their proposals, and the court would actually look at an equal time scenario. But if equal time is actually not in the child's best interests, the court then looks at substantial and significant time. And that is when we're looking at arrangements during school term, holidays, special occasions, etc. It's generally accepted proposition that shared or equal shared care, so perhaps a week about type arrangement, is not really appropriate in cases of high conflict, so that translates to the majority of people that we see in our offices here, because there is a degree of high conflict, so a shared care arrangement is not all that common. But factors in favour: you need consistent parenting styles, positive communication between the parents, etc. In terms of resolving disputes between parents, unless the case falls within a narrow set of exceptions, the parties are required to undertake family dispute resolution before any parenting proceedings can be commenced. Proceedings are commenced by filing an initiating application. If there are interim issues and the parties can't agree the immediate parenting arrangements for their children, that's set out in an interim application supported by an affidavit. And that is when the parties go into chapter and verse, each putting their respective proposals forward and perhaps criticisms of one another if relevant. This is where the family report really comes in, because that helps the judge navigate through all the affidavit material, where there's often conflicting stories or views about the history and the best arrangements moving forward.
Who produces the family report?
A psychologist who's appointed by the court. So there are psychologists in-house and also externally. Who can apply for a parenting order? Obviously parents, a child, although I've yet to see a case where that's occurred. Grandparents or anyone else, any other person concerned with the care, welfare and development of a child. So that's quite broad. The orders that are typically made by consent or can be made by the court are listed here. These are just some examples. So most orders will obviously set out the parenting arrangements for children on a week-to-week basis during school holidays, religious occasions, special occasions and so on. You can have orders about telephone communications, extracurricular activities, non-denigration clauses, attendances upon medical professionals, injunctive orders restraining a party from removing the children from the Commonwealth. We can have orders made requiring parties to complete applications for passports, putting children on the AFP alert list so children can't be removed from the Commonwealth. Recovery orders if a child is overheld, directing the AFP to go out and search and locate the child. Schooling. Parents can't make a decision about the best school for their child or children. Judges will step in if they have to. And of course, relocations, which are notoriously difficult cases. So the issue with relocation cases, unlike many other disputes that we deal with, are that the outcomes are black and white. It's very difficult to negotiate a satisfactory outcome for both parties. There's no specific provisions in the Act that deal with relocation, and they're determined in the usual manner according to the best interests and principles set out in the Act. So the court will look at the issue of relocation in the context of assessing each party's proposals, the parenting arrangements put forward in the best interests of the child. Compelling reasons for the move don't need to be shown, but in reality they do, because if you're planning to move somewhere for no legitimate reason, I don't think the proposals would be favoured. There's neither party has an onus upon them in those proceedings. So I thought I would just briefly touch on the Hague Convention, which deals with international abduction of children by parents. If you have a scenario where one party wrongfully removes a child to another country, this convention is applicable. Obviously, if the two countries in question are signatories, Australia and Israel are signatories to this convention. So the premise behind the convention is that disputes regarding the parenting arrangements or custodial arrangements for children should be determined in the country where the children were habitually resident. So we all know the case that was in the media last year or the year before about the five sisters from Italy. The whole concept there was they were habitually resident in Italy, they grew up in Italy, and the proceedings should have been determined in Italy. And ultimately, I believe that's the decision that was made by the family court here, that the children should be returned so that any proceedings concerning their living arrangements should be dealt with in Italy. There are obviously some limited exceptions. So I thought I'd just briefly touch on two case examples. This particular case, NNN, was a 1980s decision where the court had to deal with religious issues. It was a case involving two boys, aged 7 and 5, from an Orthodox Jewish family. Custody had been, as it was called back then, granted to the husband. And in this particular case, the wife was less observant. The wife appealed the decision on the basis that the trial judge placed too much weight on the religious differences between the parties. And the full court held that in most instances, the nature and degree of religious observance and proposed religious upbringing will not assume such a significance in a custody decision as it did in this particular case. You'll see that it was thought that where children are accustomed to a particular religious upbringing, it's considered more of a lifestyle issue rather than a religious issue. But in this particular case, religion was put at the forefront of both parties' cases. The full court did find that way too much emphasis and focus had been placed on that issue in this particular case, but the full court did not disturb the trial judge's decision because they found that at the end of the day, all of the factors overall favoured the husband. There are some. There was a dissenting judge who held that it was not safe to let the decision of the trial judge stand because of the significance that religious facts played in this matter. So the next decision is an early 1990s decision. I think it's quite a unique case and obviously turns on its own facts, but it dealt with a father who had custody of a 5-year-old boy who wanted to relocate to Israel. So the background to this was that the wife had an addiction to prescription drug use medication and had been hospitalised on more than 15 occasions. So there'd been previous proceedings in relation to custody. Ultimately, the father was granted custody. And then shortly after those orders were made, the wife was hospitalised again for a lengthy period of time, and then he applied to the court for orders to permit him to relocate the child to live in Israel. So the trial judge held that the husband had had a long-standing desire to live in Israel. His second wife was from Israel. He had immediate family who were living in Israel. The judge was troubled by issues in terms of security, but was persuaded, I believe, if you look at the judgment by the barrister for the husband, that those matters could be mitigated. The judge ultimately found in favour of the husband, allowed the relocation, but did so on very strict terms and conditions. So he delayed the relocation by 18 months to give this little boy more time to bond with his mother. And then he also put in place arrangements, orders enabling the child to spend time with the mother pending the relocation and subsequently, and also ordered that there be reciprocal orders made in Israel. So I thought referring to a case example might be of interest. And that's it for me. Thank you.
I'd just like to thank both Rabbi Johnson and Rebecca for presenting here today. It's quite clear that the interests of the child are paramount under both halacha and under Australian law, and also importantly that parenting is really a responsibility and not merely a right. And while we should, as Jews, sort of adhere to Jewish law because it is divine, it's nice when it actually conforms and converges with Australian law, and from our position it actually makes sense and we can understand it. So I thank you both for presenting today, and thank you for everyone for attending.